The next case on this morning's call is number 013232, the United States against Briggs.
Good morning, Your
Robertson,
Honor.
Let's let the courtroom settle down just for a moment, okay? Thank you, Mr. Robinson. You can proceed now.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Robinson. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Lamilton Briggs. Your Honor, before we begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if that's possible. We have a situation here, a criminal case, where the appellant, Mr. Briggs, has been sentenced to life in prison. It is our submission that no rational juror could have convicted Mr. Briggs based on the evidence presented at the trial, and that we would ask that this court reverse his conviction. We have a number of reasons for presenting that argument. First of all, the star witness for the government in this case was a gentleman by the name of Orlando Davis. He was the nephew to the defendant's girlfriend. Importantly, this gentleman was cooperating with the authorities for some sort of surrogate cooperation for his stepfather, I believe, who eventually received a Rule 35 departure as a result of this cooperation. Importantly, Orlando Davis came to the authorities to do this. It was not the authorities who initially investigating Mr. Briggs. Later, this same witness testified that he didn't testify, but later the same witness had written a letter to the defendant's family indicating that if they paid him $7,500, he would go away and not testify against the defendant. This was the star witness against Mr. Briggs. He set up a undercover drug transaction with Agent Avery, whereas Mr. Orlando Davis went to a location, presumably met with Mr. Briggs. He went to that location with money, and he came back with drugs. Importantly, the agents never observed Mr. Briggs during this transaction, although they did have a taped wire of this transaction where the agent identified Mr. Briggs merely through voice identification. He said he was familiar with his voice, and that's the only identification we have at this point. Importantly, the agents assumed that this transaction occurred. Orlando Davis came back with drugs and no more money. The agents assumed that this was Mr. Briggs because of the tape conversation, because of observing a vehicle presumed to be Mr. Briggs going into the area of the transaction. There's no marked money. None of the bills that the agent provide the confidential informant were marked or tagged so that they could later on be identified as the money that went in the drug transaction. The next, so in addition to this unreliable transaction that went under, that occurred, in addition to the unreliable testimony of this Orlando Davis and his questionable motives, we also have the agent's testimony in this case. Agent Avery was similarly unreliable. Importantly, we had a situation where Agent Avery, upon the arrest of the defendant, seized several pieces of drug paraphernalia, drug packaging materials, scales, things of this nature. None of this was ever fingerprinted, and none of it was ever connected to the defendant because the apartment that it was retrieved from did not belong to the defendant. This is all part of the record. However, according to Agent Avery, the connection came out of the defendant's mouth. Agent Avery indicated 4 months after this initial arrest that the defendant had admitted that the drugs and the scales and the materials were Lamilton Briggs. Notably, this was not part of the arrest report. A slam dunk fact like this was not part of the arrest report.
Well, the jury heard all this stuff.
That's correct.
You're really just, seems to me, asking us to assume the role of the second jury in this case.
You're correct in stating that, but I believe this court has the authority to do that. I think the evidence in this case was so remarkable, and the facts in this case were so remarkable that I think no rational juror could have convicted this defendant. You know, we have other facts as well in this case. A juror came forward after the verdict and indicated that she felt she was intimidated, indicated that she felt that she should not have voted guilty. She did not want to vote guilty against Mr. Briggs. She also indicated that there was another juror that was on her side initially. And all this occurred in an unusual hearing at the district court, notably, because normally this isn't inquired into. However, the juror did come forward. And I think that presents a context to view this case from. We have a juror that...
There were no outside influences.
That's correct. And Rule 606B applies to the degree that no outside influences occurred to keep this juror from voting not guilty. However, the district court did inquire into this, and these facts are on the record, and I think we should consider that in making this decision. So in summary of the insufficiency of the evidence argument that I'm presenting, we have no viewing or witnessing of the drug transaction by the agents. We're only relying upon this confidential informant, Orlando Davis. Secondly, there's no connection to the cocaine or the other drug paraphernalia that was seized by the agents. And we've got the third, inconsistent and unreliable statements coming from government agents. I'd like to touch briefly on the last three issues raised in my brief. First, Rule 606B, which Your Honor alluded to, we agree that typically this prohibits an inquiry into this type of evidence of juror misconduct. But our argument on this issue is that the defendant was deprived of a fair trial. The verdict is unreliable. We've got insufficient evidence or questionable evidence coupled with this potential juror misconduct. Next, we've also argued that Apprendi should apply to the often briefed lately Apprendi decision, Apprendi v. New Jersey. We're saying that this argument, this issue, this case should apply to prior convictions, particularly in a case like this. I know Apprendi on its face says prior convictions do not apply and are not elements of the offense. But when you have a situation where a defendant is receiving a sentence of life in prison due to two prior drug convictions, I believe that this is a situation where manifest injustice can occur and has occurred in the past and will occur in the future if we don't change this. And then lastly, we have raised the argument that 21 United States Code Section 841 is unconstitutional. Clearly, this court has already ruled on this issue. We're raising this issue to preserve the defendant's rights to pursue this issue in the future in case the court reverses itself. I'd like to save the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. We'll hear now from Mr. Bass.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, first, as to the sufficiency of the evidence claims, the short response to those claims is that the defendant is asking this court, as Judge Evans suggested, to simply reweigh the evidence or reevaluate the credibility of the witnesses, which this court has repeatedly, for many years, stated that it has refused to do. The evidence as to the distribution count was that Mr. Davis met with an agent, contacted the defendant. There was a recording of that conversation. Agent Avery identified the defendant's voice. Mr. Davis then met with the defendant at an apartment complex. There was again a recording. much of which is quoted in our brief, which clearly reflects the drug transaction. Again, Agent Avery identified that the person speaking with Mr. Davis as the defendant. And when Mr. Davis and the defendant exited or departed from the apartment complex, Agent Avery testified that the defendant was the person who departed the complex just before Mr. Davis, and Mr. Davis testified that it was the defendant from whom he received the crack cocaine. That is more than sufficient evidence, regardless of how it is weighed, for the jury to find the defendant guilty. As to count two, the possession count, the evidence established that the car that the defendant was observed driving during the distribution transaction was observed in the parking lot of the apartment complex. The apartment complex manager testified that it was the defendant who she understood and who represented himself to be the lessee of that apartment. When the agents went into the apartment, it was the defendant who came out from the area from which the crack cocaine was found. And it was he who stated to Agent Avery, and Agent Muir heard this, that it was his drugs. Now again, that evidence was before the jury, and it was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to find the defendant guilty. Unless there are any questions about the sufficiency challenges, Your Honor, I would just have one comment to make with respect to the issue with respect to the juror. This case is indistinguishable from Ford, which we cite, which I've cited extensively in our brief. There's no claim of any extraneous evidence before the jury, as Judge Evans indicated. And it wasn't the defendant who asked for an interview of the juror. It was the government who suggested to Judge Mim, to remove any question at all about this matter, that the Judge Mim could authorize the defendant to contact the juror and to interview her and transcribe it. And that is what was done. And again, when the juror herself was contacted, as the transcript of that phone call reflects, she testified or she made statements which only went to what went on inside that jury room. And those are the kinds of things that this court has repeatedly said, and Rule 606B clearly says, is not a matter for the judge to inquire. And lastly, Your Honors, as to the claim about the prior convictions. Not only has the Supreme Court accepted prior convictions as being elements of the offense or required to be submitted to a jury, but it's rather ironic that defendants who repeatedly come before this court and argue that it was reversible error that convictions came in under Rule 404B now to stand before you and say that these convictions should have been submitted to the jury. And in any event, in this case, the defendant specifically stipulated to these elements instructions, and regardless of whether it's an element of the offense or not, that issue was specifically waived. So for all these reasons, Your Honors, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Bass. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. 1 minute and 5 seconds.
Thank you very much. I want to note a couple of things for the court. First of all, we're not arguing that a drug transaction didn't occur. We're clearly a drug transaction occurred at some point. We're arguing that it wasn't our defendant, wasn't the appellant. We don't know if it was the appellant. Obviously, there is a conviction here. We're arguing that the evidence was insufficient to support that conviction. The confession that the government talks about occurred. First of all, it's questionable whether that confession ever occurred. That's our point. If a confession occurs at the moment of arrest that drugs belong to a particular defendant, why wouldn't that be part of a police report? Why would it be discussed 4 months later with the prosecutor when the agent and the prosecutor get together and talk about the case? Clearly, they had to have some connection to these drugs for him to be convicted of possessing them. Merely being in the apartment is not sufficient to convict an individual for possession of any type of narcotics, not constructive or actual. And then,
Mr. Robinson, your time has.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson, I notice you have served by appointment to the court, and the court wants to express its deep thanks to you for the good job you did on behalf of your client.
Thank you very much.